Okay, this is Zechariah chapter 12. Hopefully we'll discuss the last three chapters of Zechariah this evening. In my 2013 commentary on Zechariah, I titled this section presenting Zechariah chapters 12 and 13 as Prophet of the Revelation. His prophecies concerning Judah and Jerusalem and Israel here can't have anything to do with 70 AD or with anything that happened in ancient Judea. They can only have something to do with the end of days, so to speak, or the final culmination of the judgment of God. And for that reason, when I presented Zechariah chapter 14, I titled that Prophet of the Holocaust. And that's not the World War II Holocaust that never even happened. That's the coming Holocaust, which actually finalizes and culminates the wrath of God. So what we have here is basically far vision prophecies that don't really make any sense as near vision prophecies. They weren't fulfilled in 70 AD. The circumstances are completely different than anything that happened in the time of the Seleucids or in the time of the Romans and the destruction of Jerusalem. That this prophecy can't be pointing at those things, but we will see that it also ties into the Revelation and certain language in the Revelation concerning the return of Christ and the final destruction of his enemies. So these prophecies go hand in hand with the return of Christ in Revelation chapter 19 and the way that's described, and also with the surrounding of the camp of the saints in Revelation chapter 20 and the way that's described. And I hope that becomes clear as we read this evening. That's all I have to say.
And should I cut chapter 12 in half?
You shouldn't like be too much time. Stop where you're comfortable.
Okay.
12 really isn't that long.
Okay. Zechariah chapter 12. The burden of the word of Yahweh for Israel, saith Yahweh, which stretcheth forth the heavens and layeth the foundations of the earth, and formeth the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut into pieces. Though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it, in that day, saith Yahweh, I will smite every horse with astonishment, and his rider with madness. And I will open mine eyes unto the house of Judah, and will smite every horse of the people with blindness. And the governors of Judah shall say in their heart, that inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be my strength in Yahweh of hosts their God. And in that day I will make governors of Judah like a hearth of fire among wood, and a torch of fire in a sheaf. And they shall devour all the people round about, on the right hand and on the left, and Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. Yahweh shall also save the tents of Judah first, that glory of the house of David, and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem did not magnify themselves against Judah. In that day shall Yahweh defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble among them, and at that day shall be as David, and the house of David shall be as God, as the angel of Yahweh before them. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem, and I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirits of grace and supplication. And they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as once they mourned for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him, as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. In that day shall there be a great mourning in Jerusalem, as the mourning of Hadarimon in the valley of Megiddon. And the land shall mourn every family apart, the family of the house of David apart, their wives apart, their families of the house of Nathan apart, and their wives apart, the family of the house of Levi apart, and their wives apart from the family of Shem apart, and their wives apart. All the families that remain, every family apart, and their wives apart. End of chapter 12.
I can't say that the fulfillment of this was in the period of the Seleucids or in the period of the aftermath of the time of Christ in 70 AD. It certainly wasn't. And Jerusalem wasn't defended at that time. It was destroyed. There was a revival with the Maccabees in the second century BC, but they didn't go around and devour all the surrounding nations. Rather, they converted them to Judaism and polluted their priesthood and polluted the nation. So that this does not describe the time of the Maccabees, and it can't describe the time of 70 AD when Jerusalem was actually destroyed and it wasn't defended. This has to be talking about the far vision and the last days when Yahweh defends Jerusalem and Judah once and for all for good. This language in verse 11, the Valley of Megiddon, is the same place that's referred to in a revelation as Armageddon. Armageddon is the mountain of Megiddon, or the mountain of Megiddo. And Megiddo was a valley in between mountains, so either term makes sense. In the land of Israel to the north, almost as far north as Galilee, I believe. If it wasn't in Galilee, it was the end of that. I believe Megiddon was the termination or near the end of that highway. I call it a highway, but it was sort of a route that Abraham and Isaac had traveled to go from Hebron to Beersheba and back. It was a route that was on a plateau in the mountains. And not, you didn't have to go down off the mountains to the plain to travel it back and forth. I talked about that recently in a Genesis commentary. So Megiddon was at the northern end of that road that went from Beersheba almost all the way to Galilee. And it was mountains and a valley. So both descriptions, Har Megiddo or Armageddon, or Armageddon is the mountain of Megiddo. And here we have similar language, which tells me that this passage in Zechariah isn't fulfilled yet, not until Revelation chapter 19 is fulfilled. Which, if I remember correctly, is where Armageddon is mentioned in Revelation chapter 16, gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon, and the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air. And there came out a great voice of the temple from the throne saying, "It is done." That's the judgment of God, and that Revelation chapter 16 is, I believe, that's the great harvest, and that's not, it doesn't come before Revelation 19. I believe it's a parallelism that's describing those events in a different way. I'm sorry, you were saying?
I was just going to say how I can really see everyone mourning when Christ comes back. Everyone who's spoken all these impious words against him, I can see a lot of people mourning when they see him and they know that he is true and he is the one and he exists, and now they have to answer for every single word.
Right, absolutely. And that's the day we all anticipate, because if you're truly a Christian, you know that he's true and you know this is going to happen. Even if it sounds incredulous, you know it's going to happen, and that's the day we anticipate. It's interesting here that the house of David, and there are other prophecies that inform us that the house of David would never rule again over Judah in Jerusalem. And here it seems to be that the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem are actually divided against Judah, which seems to be odd, but it may not be odd once you understand who the true players are, the identities of these people in modern times.
Look at this, Bill. It says at verse 6, I will make the governors of Judah like an hearth of fire among the wood and like a torch of fire in a sheath. Doesn't that remind you of the house of Jacob shall be a flame, and the house of Joseph, and the house of Esau for stubble? What is that one again? In Obadiah?
Yes, that's in Obadiah 16:17.
Right. And then just above that, at verse 3, you've got, I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut to pieces. So every nation that comes against Judah will be destroyed.
Yes, at that time, in the last time.
And at verse 4, you've got, I will smite every horse with astonishment and his rider with madness, right? So this reminds me of either the time of Gideon, when the armies went crazy and started killing each other because they were astonished, they didn't know what was happening, or the time of Hezekiah, where the armies marched up to Hezekiah's Jerusalem, the city, and then the Lord smites them with madness and they start killing each other. And we've got that verse, I believe it's in Ezekiel, where every man's sword shall be against his brother.
Yes.
Yep.
So all of this here is like every nation that comes against us will be destroyed in the end. The holy city, all these profane nations that come against the holy city, they'll all be destroyed. And, fire come down from heaven, they'll be smited with madness and start killing each other. They'll be smited by us. And you've got the mighty men here. Even the feeble will be as strong as David. And the governors of Jerusalem, the people will be their strength. And they will destroy it even says at verse 9, I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem.
Right, absolutely. Jerusalem isn't, of course, Jerusalem in Palestine. Jerusalem is in prophecy, it's the seats of administration of the people of God, or it's the city of God come down from heaven, the new Jerusalem, which is actually his people. It's not really a physical city that's coming down out of the sky. It represents the people, the children of God that are born from above is what it represents, in my opinion. And that's why that the 12 gates have the names of the patriarchs of the 12 tribes upon them, because you're not one of those people that belong to the city of God unless you're from one of those tribes.
There's two really great Christ is God verses here in this chapter, and one of them
in the Lord of hosts, their God. So that's exactly what you're saying. Jerusalem is the rulers, the seat of government, the seat of power. So at verse 5, you have the governors of Judah counting on the people of Jerusalem.
Right.
And it's a city come down, it's the holy city, the city come down from heaven.
Yes. Yeah, certainly not that hellhole in Palestine that's...
Get real good, no way.
Cesspool now. That was left desolate, as Christ proclaimed it.
Yeah, and it's the gayest city on earth, isn't it? So why would God defend that city? The city of mongrel sodomites
that reject him openly,
that hate him
and actually hate him.
Yeah, he won't defend it, but he might be magnified there.
Right, coming out of Bozrah. Who is this coming out of Bozrah? Covered in blood. Coming out of Edom. So he might be magnified there, you know.
Well, he says he'll be magnified there in Malachi. And yeah, that's exactly how.
So he's coming out of Edom and he's covered in blood. Well, what is Jerusalem? You know, what is that city today, Israel? Edom shall build up the ruined places. So the Jews must be Edom. And then we have prophecies about Christ coming out of Edom covered in blood.
Yep. And
that's Malachi 1, chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. And even though that's a crystal clear prophecy of Edom returning to build the desolate places, and those desolate places must be the places that Christ declared shall be left to his adversaries desolate. And even though they are the adversaries of Christ, because they deny Christ to this very day, they despise Christians, they deny Christ, they belittle him. No matter how clearly you explain that to the typical Judeo-Christian, they still don't get it. They can't understand it. Something's going to have to make them understand it sooner or later.
They're scared of the Jews instead of God.
Yeah, but they're just totally brainwashed in this Judeo-Churchianity paradigm that they don't have the ability to understand anything else.
Yeah. And they're afraid to, in a sense, because they've convinced themselves into believing that any form of hate is somehow bad and somehow against God. So they're afraid to hate anything.
Jacob I love and Esau I hate. That's two bodies of people.
Yeah. And the house of David shall be as God, and they will look at me who they pierced. So two really good verses here. Christ is God.
Right. Absolutely. They shall look upon me whom they have pierced is clearly Yahweh speaking here. So Yahweh must be the Messiah whom they pierced in 33 AD. You confront the Orthodox with this and they just try to speak circles around it, but they can't really counter it.
It's like when you ask them to count, Bill, and they'll still count. It'll be like one. Yahweh is one. Yes, but three. And it's like, what? Yeah. No, it one.
Oh, yeah.
Can you count
you
to one?
You have to stop counting at one, right?
Yeah, isn't it written somewhere, in that day Yahweh will be one and his name one. I can't remember where that is.
I think that the last three verses, when it keeps using the word apart, is a poor translation or perhaps antiquated, because it's really, it seems to be saying on their own. If you look at the Hebrew, it's really like a positive, in the positive sense, as opposed to the negative sense, the way I think that most people would interpret it these days, like these people are apart from each other. It's actually saying they'll each mourn on their own individually.
Yeah, I'm looking at my old commentary, and I didn't really even comment on that. But it seems that that would be I mean, that's the way it's interpreted internally anyway when you read it. That's what I was saying.
Yeah.
That the NAS basically has that, the family of the house of Levi by itself, because it's talking about the family, and their wives by themselves, the family of the Shimeites by itself, and their wives by themselves. Yeah, it's speaking about being on one's own, so to speak.
I wonder why these names are singled out. I wonder if it maybe has a similar purpose to why names are singled out in the opening chapters of Micah. Is there some sort of allegorical meaning here? David means beloved. I know that.
In the Septuagint, it's also by themselves. I'm sorry, Noble. I was trying to look that up. I'm having a problem with my Bible works. It's just not set up. It keeps crashing, so I can't get it set up. I'm sorry. You were saying?
Well, I was just saying, I wonder if there's a reason why these specific names are mentioned here, it being a far vision prophecy. I wonder if they have some sort of allegorical meaning.
Family of Nathan, family of Levi.
I mean, like family of like House of David. So like leading people, House of Nathan, sort of like prophets, House of Levi, like a priestly class. And then again, how does that really apply to a far vision prophecy, though? And Shimei, I can't remember who that is.
Well, Shimei, there were apparently a few Shimeis. So I would have to read through them all to see which one it might be talking about. But there is a Shimei in Ezra chapter 10. But Ezra chapter 10, the events of Ezra chapter 10 are about 70 years after Zechariah, maybe 60. So it probably isn't him. There's another Shimei in 2 Chronicles chapter 31, but he looks like a member of the house of the king, Jeconiah, and he's not. Oh, okay, he's a Levite. Konaniah, the Levite. I mistook that for Jeconiah, who's sometimes called Konaniah. This is Konaniah, the Levite. So Shimei, his brother, was next. So there is in the days of Hezekiah, there's a Shimei that's a high priest that was next in line, the high priest. He was a priest that was next in line to the high priest, right? In the time of Hezekiah. So that seems to be the most notable one I could find. It might be mentioned here, but he'd be long dead by this time of Zechariah. I mean, 180 years before him. So it might just be that Shimei means, because it means notable or renowned, that the name is being used to indicate the most renowned of the family of the Levites. We don't know who the house of David is in the world today. The actual members, we don't know them today. They've got to be in the world. And we don't know the Levites, who they are today in the world. There's certainly none of them are Jews. But the bottom line is that perhaps this is just to show that the highest families or castes, so to speak, are the royal house and the priestly house. And that the most notable of them will be mourning by themselves at this time. Right. And they should be mourning by themselves because they're the ones that should have been the shepherds, and they failed. They failed for all these centuries.
I can really see that.
So that's the only way that I could relate that to a far vision. I don't remember what I said in my commentary. There were two prominent men named Nathan in the life of David, one being Nathan the prophet, the other one being his son Nathan, who was born to him in Jerusalem, and who was also reckoned among the worldly ancestors of Christ. So the Nathan mentioned here must refer to the son of David, as Shimei was also a son of Levi. So there must have been another Shimei that was a son of Levi. So we see described among the mourners, the shepherds of the tribes of Israel, which are Judah and Levi, and certain families distinguished among them. These are the shepherd tribes, the tribes from which the rulers and leaders of the people were principally derived. And throughout the prophecy of Zechariah, Yahweh has uttered his dissatisfaction with the shepherds of Israel. So I basically said the same thing in different language, in using different terms that I just said. The remnant of Judah and Levi were responsible for creating the Edomite Jews in the first place when they used force to convert all of the surrounding people to Judaism from 150 years before the crucifixion. So I basically said the same thing, that these are the shepherd families, the leader families, and that they totally forsook their duties and their obligations. So they should be mourning by themselves. That's my opinion. That's the far vision. If you have obligations and responsibilities above everybody else and you fail, that then you should mourn all that much more and repent all that much more, right?
Yeah.
To he who is given much, much shall be expected.
Yes.
Thank you.
After Gog and Magog are destroyed in Ezekiel, in the final verses of Ezekiel 39, we see this same concept of a pouring out of spirit. And I wonder if that could somehow possibly be related to the latter rain. I think that would make sense. We see it here in verse 10. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications.
Right, but I think we also see it here in verse 8, where it says, he that is feeble among them at that day shall be as David.
That could be it too, making their hooves brass and their horns iron.
Right. I don't know how that's going to happen with three generations of total soy boys.
God can walk on water. He can divide the Red Sea, and he can make soy boys strong.
I hope.
Maybe they're like the generation that dies in the desert and a new generation comes up.
Yeah, these Zoomers seem like really cynical of the world, that they really are cynical of the world. And I could see a whole generation of them growing up just hating these fucking Jews in this modern paradigm that they seem to be. A lot of them seem to be going in that direction. So maybe.
Yeah, that's the impression that I got when I was in high school. They all sort of have that undercurrent if they're smart enough to not be distracted by the sports ball. But they all try and find distractions. Not a whole lot have the balls to, I don't know, find out, you know, the man behind the, what's it, the man behind the curtain. That's what I'm thinking of, Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, well, when I was a kid, things were a lot better economically. There were a lot more job opportunities for a lot of people. So it was easier for people to be comfortable with the system, even if they knew something was wrong with it.
Yeah, I think about that Roman tactic, bread and circuses. I think the Jew likes doing that a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've always imagined, and I can't pretend to know the future, but I've always imagined that Yahweh would give us some sort of guidance and protection when we're threshing, because I can't imagine us losing numbers when that day comes. I can't imagine it being sort of a conflict where we're losing some on our side too. I view it as, you know, a supernatural thing. Yahweh is with us. He's giving us strength. It's sort of like the lesson of Gideon, right? So making the most feeble of them as strong as David, I just see as, you know, Yahweh putting his hand upon his people.
I've always wondered, Noble, you know, the Adamic man is supposed to be restored to immortality and will be changed in the blink of an eye. I've always wondered if that happens and then
before. Right? I've thought about that too, if it happens before. And I've thought, is that in Micah 4 when you read, and their horns will be iron and their hooves brass, is that a reference to invincibility? Is that a reference to that changing, that they're unstoppable because they've been changed? Yeah, I've considered that. We can't know, but I do view the feeble among them and this day shall be as David. That's Yahweh giving his people strength, even the weakest among them, because their victory is now certain. And I just can't, again, see us losing numbers in that day. I don't see threshing that way. I don't see threshing as like an equal one-on-one ratio battle. I view it as, you know, the other side are doomed, and they are doomed regardless, but I view them as just, it's a slaughter. I view it as a slaughter of the aliens, that they have no chance.
There's also that verse about, like, it's talking about the heroes of Israel, and it's talking about how they turned the armies of the aliens to flight. And then you go back to those verses in David, and you have these mighty heroes who are like one against a thousand. You're like, how did they do that? One against a thousand, or whatever it is. One and another one against 100. All these mighty men of David, and that's like a type, I would think, for the day you're speaking of, Noble.
I would think so. That's the whole lesson of Gideon. That's the whole lesson. Like when we have this victory, no one's going to think that we threshed the aliens and we did it because we were so mighty. Everyone's going to understand it was miraculous. Everyone's going to understand, like, wow, Yahweh was with us. Either his hand was upon us or Christ is threshing with us literally, which is also extremely possible.
There can be no doubt that Yahweh was, you know, like there's that story about the sun didn't set. The sun was still in the sky and they slaughtered from noon to noon. And there was no doubt that God was with them. Yeah, there has to be no doubt. It has to be a sign. I agree with that. It'd have to be a sign that God is with them and it's a miraculous victory. Unbelievable carnage.
Yeah,
the enemy is struck with astonishment and madness, and it's incredible.
Yeah, that's how it's described. Like you said, carnage. It's not described as like, oh, we're taking hits. It's described as Yahweh has put his hand upon his people, and it's a slaughter. And yeah, that would be quite a sight to see people among us who are weak yet angry, and just they're invincible because Yahweh has put his hand upon them. And everyone should praise Yahweh. You know, Paul speaks of us boasting in Yahweh because of the wisdom he gives to us. In this day, men will be boasting in Yahweh for the strength he gives to them.
May he be glorified.
Yes.
Well, chapter 13 is a short chapter. That's a hint that maybe we should just be moving on a little bit.
Oi, Jackson.
And they should have ended chapter 12 at 13:1. I don't really agree with this chapter.
Almost all the chapter divisions just suck.
Yeah, they all suck, but like, why are they starting at 13:1 here? That should be in chapter 12. Yeah, they all suck.
I would agree, but if I was doing the Old Testament and the New, if I could do it over with, right? If I wanted to do a New Testament right, I wouldn't have chapter divisions. I'd have sections.
Yeah, because it's too much of a mental block for some people.
Yeah, they stop reading at the end of the chapter and they miss a whole lot of context from the beginning of the next one. Or they start at the beginning of the chapter and they miss a whole lot of context from the end of the last one. They do it all the time.
That's me. That's me, honestly. As soon as a new chapter starts, you can forget everything that happened before it.
No, that's not true. That's not true.
A lot of Judeo-Christians say that they don't say that. I'm sorry. They act that way about verses. They just take one verse from scripture and put it in any context they want.
Sometimes I take half a verse, Bill. I'll take a few words here, a few words there.
Yeah, yeah, the world. Joking. You see that? It says the world.
Or you have the good old battle of the verses where this verse tops that verse.
Yeah.
Like so many people I try to explain that to that don't ever fucking get it.
Yeah, I'm going to try and refute Christ with this other verse from Paul that says all men.
Yeah.
Yeah, like
Paul said all men there, so Christ is wrong. It's like, wasn't Paul like a student of Christ? Like, how is he refuting Christ?
You know when you're playing cards and some hands are stronger than other hands? Well, some verses are stronger than other verses. Yeah.
Well, we could just have a battle royal and throw them all into a ring and see which one is the actual truth.
Oh, no. John 3:16 will definitely win. I'm telling you now.
It trumps
that's
everything.
That's the most powerful verse of all.
It's like the ace in the hole.
Jackson, you awake or what?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. Are you ready for a 13?
Let's roll, buddy.
Let's roll, buddy.
All right. Zechariah chapter 13. In that day, there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and uncleanliness. And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols out of the land, and they shall no more be remembered. And I will cause the prophets and the unclean spirits to pass out of the land. And it shall come to pass that when any shall yet prophesy, then his father and his mother that begat him shall say unto him, for thou shalt not live, for thou speakest lies in the name of Yahweh. And his father and his mother that begat him shall thrust him through when he prophesieth. And it shall come to pass in that day that the prophet shall be ashamed, every one his vision, and he hath prophesied, neither shall they wear a rough garment to deceive. But he shall say, I am no prophet, I am an husbandman, for man taught me to keep cattle from my youth. And one shall say unto him, what are these wounds in thy hands? And he shall answer, those which I was wounded in the house of my fields. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow, saith Yahweh of hosts. Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn mine hand upon the little ones. And it shall come to pass in all that land, saith Yahweh, two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein. And I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and they will try them as gold is tried. And they shall call on my name, and I will hear them. And I will say, it is my people. And they shall say, Yahweh is my God. End of chapter 13.
Well, he's going to...
Go ahead, Joe.
I was just going to say on the last verse, he's going to bring us through the flames. And all the tares will be burned away, but we will still stand. We can pass through the flames with God.
Absolutely. And going through that experience is how we're refined, right? Having that experience, those people will be refined. They'll be much better people for having had that horrible experience or that gruesome experience or however you want to describe it. These prophets must be false prophets. I mean, most of the prophets all throughout history have been false prophets. And that's why they wear a rough garment to deceive. Maybe not today. Today they have jet planes and $500 suits, or probably $500 suits cost a lot more than $500 today. $5,000 suits. The rough garment was what John the Baptist wore, the camel hair garment. The prophets of old wore rough garments as a sign that they were prophets, and as a sign that they were ascetics, more or less, that they gave up worldly enjoyments in order to be closer to God.
So these preachers of today who give false interpretations of the Bible, they're basically false prophets.
Well, right, they are. And the day is going to come that even their parents tell them, oh, shut the hell up. That they're just going to be chastised for doing that.
So thrust him through, we shouldn't take that literally.
Well, I would. Maybe they will. I don't know.
I would have to interpret this as being sort of in the process then of Mystery Babylon falling, and not afterwards when the kingdom is established, because we can't really kill each other in the kingdom. As far as we know, like that doesn't make sense. That doesn't align with the prophets and the writings.
Eternal life, in the kingdom.
Yeah, so I would have to interpret this then as being sort of in the process of our awakening, in the process of that latter rain.
But isn't really that what we have here in verses 7, 8, 9?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you're right.
So, yeah.
I could imagine receiving the latter rain, and it speaks of visions and us seeing signs and wonders. It'll become very evident in those coming days, perhaps, who is a false prophet and who isn't, in the sense of interpreting prophecy and following Yahweh. And we pray that Joel Osteen and men like that just start getting impaled by their relatives.
Or even your average neighborhood Judeo-Christian priest that's still preaching that God loves everybody, Jesus loves everybody, and we should all race mix it up.
Yeah, like this seems to be indicating that as the third ministry of Elijah escalates, that people will start waking up enough to want to kill these people. And that's a beautiful thing. I can't wait, because we're very lukewarm right now.
Well, I think as Babylon falls, I would like to think that we have the ability to do more as it crumbles, right?
Yeah, because the police can't stop you. There's right. No, yeah.
We won't be shackled so much by tyranny. That's what I'm hoping, anyway.
I think, you know, what will happen is some of these false prophets will repent, but some of them will try to cling on to Babylon as it falls, and they're the ones who are going to be like, you know, shut up. You're going to get thrust through. You need to stop clinging to you. You're a false prophet now. Like, they've actually sinned at that point, because it's all so obvious that they were wrong, and they still won't repent. So at that point, you know, I would think.
Well, I can't use the prophecy to see the future, but I pray that's certainly the case with verses 4 and 5, that the prophets become ashamed, every one of his vision. Which basically to me means that all of these Judeo preachers become ashamed of what they've been teaching.
Yeah, so a few years ago, he was like, I had a dream, and I saw the Virgin Mary, and she was speaking to me, and Christ came, and he had an afro, and it was beautiful.
And
now you're coming to them. They're like, what? No, I'm not a prophet. I'm just a farmer.
Yeah.
Like, what are you... I never said
that. You know what's kind of funny? Didn't Amos say that? I'm not a prophet. I'm just a shepherd.
Yeah. When Yahweh sent Amos to that temple. Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
I'm not a prophet. I'm just a shepherd.
Yeah, and keep in mind, like, you know, when Babylon falls, people are going to be very hungry. It's like maybe you eat a sandwich once a week, that kind of stuff. And you have your children dying and a lot of hardship. And when some guy starts talking bullshit, I mean, you're probably going to kill him, right?
Yeah, I pray.
Because you're going to be fed up and really pissed off. We're not going to be living in any sort of luxury.
No, and that's Yahweh putting us through the fire, as it says here. Two-thirds will die.
That's actually in Amos 7:14. Speaking to Amaziah, the king of Judah. I was no prophet. Neither was I a prophet's son, but I was a herdman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit. But then he went on Yahweh told him to go prophesy to Israel, right? But that's just funny. I was no prophet. And here it's saying that of the false prophets. And one shall say to him, what are these wounds in thine hands?
It's in the chest in other translations.
In the chest? Let's look at that.
It says,
"In the scepter,
what are these wounds between your arms?"
I'm sorry. Go on.
Sorry, Bill. Oh, well, in the NASB, it has, what are these wounds between your arms? And in the AMP, which is the Amplified Bible, it says, what are these wounds on your breast or between your hands? So it seems to be saying, you know, between your arms. So most people might cross-reference this to Christ.
Yeah, but the word is yada or yad, and that's a hand. It's yad dan, I think, here. It has a suffix on it, meaning my. But yad, it's a hand. It's the letter yad with a D, daleth, and that's a forearm or a hand. It's Strong's number 3027. It's definitely yod. It's definitely a hand. So I don't know how they get chest out of that.
Likely Jews crying.
It seems like Jews that are trying to avoid this being a messianic prophecy of Christ.
I think they do that in Isaiah. They argue about the word virgin.
Yeah. They do.
That is shameful.
Yeah, Joe, this is definitely hand. The word means hand, without a doubt.
The shameful part is that, you know, the translations which Joe is reading from, these are like Christian translations, which is really sad.
Yeah, the NAS has between your arms, and that's just bullshit. It doesn't say that. There's no word there for between that I could see. There is a word that means an interval or a space. There's no word for you for your. I don't know. It's what are these wounds in my hands seems to be a fair interpretation. The Greek has between thy hands, though, in the midst of thy hands. It's not really between. It's in the midst of your hands.
So when they look at this false prophet and they say to him, where are these wounds in your hands? Is that sort of like them saying to him, you know, like, hey, look, you taught Christianity, or you said you taught Christianity in the past.
Well, here's a man that I am no prophet. I am a husbandman, for man taught me to keep cattle from my youth. Now that's speaking of a prophet that's ashamed. And one shall say unto him, what are these wounds in thy hands? Then he shall answer, those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends. I would want to translate this from the beginning, right? I'm being honest.
Yeah, like, is it supposed to be him there? And, like, are the pronouns right?
Yeah. In 2013, I wrote that Christians, those bearing the gospel of Christ, should allegorically bear the marks of Christ. As Paul told the Galatians, for I bear the marks of the Lord Jesus in my body. So legitimate prophets of God in the Christian era carry the gospel of Christ as their message. And maybe Paul was referring to this passage when he said that.
Right.
Joshua Christ claimed to be the shepherd, the good shepherd, but during his earthly ministry, he never claimed to be directly a prophet, letting others do that for him. So he sets an example for those who aspire to be true prophets that they should be shepherds instead, caring for the flocks of God. Joshua Christ, the good shepherd, bore the wounds in his hands when he was wounded in the house of his friends. Of course, it may be protested that the Edomite Jews were not his friends, and that is true. The devils could never be the friends of God, but Judea and Jerusalem were not rightfully the house of the Edomite Jews. Rather, the Edomite Jews were infiltrators into the house and the body of the people of God.
In that paper, Bill, you also reference Paul's verse from Galatians where he says, for I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus.
I just said that, Joe.
Oh, okay. You cut out a little bit. Sorry.
Oh.
I didn't hear that.
I'm sorry. Well, yeah, that's why context is everything here. Even though not all of this refers to Christ, Christ makes an example of this as the true shepherd.
Right.
Awake, go sword against my shepherd and against the man who is my fellow, saith Yahweh of hosts, smite the shepherd and the sheep shall be scattered. As it is recorded in Matthew chapter 26 and Mark chapter 14, Christ had cited this verse in reference to himself.
We're still scattered.
Yes, they're still scattered. So I said, but while that may be the near vision fulfillment of Zechariah 13:7, there also seems to be a far vision fulfillment, which is already underway on the surface. This may be dismissed as conjecture, but it should have a clear historic manifestation to those who are learned. Explaining this, I must take it for granted that those who may listen are already familiar with prophetic interpretations offered elsewhere. Often identity Christians insist that the house of David should be ruling over the world today rather than the Edomite Jews, who are its de facto rulers. And it is also evident that many of the European houses of royalty have become Jews, already become Jews by blood, since they have been intermarrying with Jewish merchants and usurers for the past several centuries. In Revelation chapter 20, we read, and I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given on them, and I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Christ and for the altar of God. I'm trying to shorten this a little. But Revelation chapter 20 does not follow the chapters which precede it. Rather, it is a literary parallelism which offers an alternate description of events and coincides with the prophecies found in the preceding chapters. So verse 7 of this chapter of Zechariah has a far vision fulfillment. The clue to that fulfillment must be in Revelation chapter 17, where the kingdom is handed over to the beast, for God has put it in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and to give their kingdom to the beast. This explains how the transition was made from those who ruled in Christ to the emergence of Satan from the pit and the rule of Edomite Jew over world affairs today. So if the children of Israel, while the children of Israel were promised to be always ruled by someone of the seed of David, at some point their kingdom is handed over to the beast. This would explain a transition from the rule of Christ on earth to the time when the devil is led out of the pit and is able to deceive all of the nations. That's the end of the millennial kingdom, right? For the 1,000 years. But the kingdom had to be, to have to be handed over to the beast. The true shepherds of the people must have somehow been smitten. So this is, I'm saying that this is, has a near vision fulfillment in the time of Christ, but it has a far vision fulfillment. And that would be the destruction of European royalty and the nobility in the turmoil of 18th century Europe and the emancipation of the Jews and the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution and other revolutions like that. The wars. I equated that to the falling, the key of David falling in Isaiah chapter 22. So that's what I said was the far vision fulfillment of this prophecy, and the smiting of the shepherd is really Christ as a type for the smiting of the shepherds of Israel after that 1,000-year kingdom of his in the Middle Ages, when Christianity virtually ruled all of Europe. And now that Satan is left out of the pit, here we are, and we're being dragged through the fire. In verses 8-9.
Satan did a good job, because all of Europe was ruled by Christianity, and now they've undermined it to the point where most people are agnostic or atheist. And
right, they deny, they even laugh at Christians. They deny being Christian at all. Most European Jews. It's a lot worse than the situation in the colonies.
We've had quite a few people in the chat lately who don't seem to be that studied, and I won't give any names, that have called for violence and for us to fight back against our captivity, you know, and maybe they were trolls in the chat, because here's yet another example that if you're doing that, you're really fighting against God, because he's the author of our punishment, because here it says, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd," like Yahweh is the one directing the sword.
That's a constant challenge that I have with a lot of younger men.
I've always said that to them. They're like, what, are you going to go to war against God?
Yeah. And I will turn my hand upon the little ones.
What I try to explain it is that if you look at most normies in the world today, which are the vast majority of white people are normies, I mean, people that know anything like we know are only like a tenth of 1%. Maybe not even. It's hard to imagine that people deserve salvation at this point, because they're so in such a deep apostasy from God and from everything that's right. These white folk, most white folk out in the world today, they accept and get along with Jews, they accept and get along with sodomy and lesbians and all these other sinners, and do they really deserve salvation? Should we really act on their behalf? No, they deserve punishment, and we have to just stand aside and watch the circus. And that's frustrating. I understand that's frustrating, but what other choice do we have? People don't deserve salvation if they're indulging in sin.
Here where we see one third of the people surviving, that reminds me of when Paul wrote about fulfilling your obedience so that you can avenge disobedience. Because we see this one third here have fulfilled their obedience, and now they're worthy.
Right, but it has to be a third. It can't be just a couple of hundred people like the people we have on this chat that are sprinkled across the country. That ain't a third. That ain't going to do anything.
It's hard to cross-reference these verses without the benefit of hindsight, but it sort of reminds me of that prophecy in Revelation of Mystery Babylon falling and being divided into three pieces.
Well, that's the great city that fell in Revelation chapter 11 that fell into three pieces.
No, that's not Mystery Babylon?
Well, I mean, It is representative of Mystery Babylon. It's in Revelation chapter 16. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. 16.
That is, it's just not in Revelation 18. It's Revelation chapter 16, but that is speaking of the same Mystery Babylon. Yes.
Revelation 18, isn't that just sort of a longer explanation of the seventh bowl?
Yeah, that's what I believe, and this is a foreshadowing of it. But I thought this was earlier. I really did think the three parts were back in chapter 11 or 12. I can't remember it all, man.
Yeah, so it is Mystery Babylon, and it just sort of reminds me of it, like these two verses here. Yeah. We see it in Zechariah, we see it in Revelation.
I'm looking at this verse too, and it says, "And I also will cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land." Could an unclean spirit be unclean people? Because even if it doesn't refer to unclean people, I think unclean spirits tend to dwell among unclean people.
Yeah, yeah, you see that in Acts, sort of. It's subtle. I wonder if it's a kathratos or koinos in the Septuagint.
Which verse is it?
I have to check that.
Which verse is it?
Verse 2.
I'm looking towards the end. Okay. The unclean spirit, that's singular. It's singular in a Septuagint.
Could that be the same as the singular false prophet in Revelation? Sort of like a type for just all the Jewish propaganda?
It's also singular in the actual Hebrew in Zechariah 13 too. So In that manner, it's speaking about the general attitude of the people, perhaps. It's not just an unclean spirit. It's that the three unclean frogs represent spirits, which are bad teachings, bad doctrines, bad ideas or concepts in that manner. Which I equate to liberty, fraternity, and equality, which has brought us all these problems with diversity. And
so perhaps when this unclean spirit passes out of the land, they start calling the liberals vile.
Perhaps, yes.
Well, now what with what you say, Bill, the prophets and the unclean spirit, well, the prophets must have been teaching unclean things and the people were going along with him. So he causes this false teaching of like universalism and multiculturalism that passes out of the land. And the people are sanctified once that passes out of the land. That's what I'm thinking now.
Right. Well, it goes hand in hand with the idols, Joe. Yes. They're associated with the idolatry in this verse, this unclean spirit. What's clean about Judeo-Christianity, or what's clean about pop culture? Judeo-Christianity is essentially pop culture. It has all the same objectives as pop culture. We are the world, we are the children, we're all together, we're all one. That's Judeo-Christianity also. It reflects all those same values, those same communist values.
That gay ass Michael Jackson song. I hate that song. We are the world. So fucking gay.
I hate that song too, but I don't think it was Michael Jackson.
Oh, I thought it was him. Okay.
Oh,
he was in it. There's a bunch of pop stars.
Yeah, you know, this was me. Yeah, it was a whole bunch of them. It was a whole.
Okay. It was before my time. I wasn't even born when that happened.
Well, I had to live through that shit. It sucked. and I hated it.
When I was born, Michael Jackson wasn't black anymore.
No, he was worm bait.
He was still black. You know, just because he bleaches his skin. What are you? You think skin only? His race is only skin deep, Noble?
I was making a
joke.
I
don't think so.
I was making a joke. I know. But he was crazy. Anyways.
Yeah, Bill. Well, did you guys ever...
Oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, it was pertaining to Michael Jackson. It's not about Bible study.
Yeah, well, what you said, though, earlier about Judeo-Christianity being pop culture, it's a codified version of pop culture.
Yeah.
And it gives substance to it for the average man, meaning it's reinforced to the average man. Yeah.
No doubt. I totally agree. Now, I remember when I was a kid, when I first heard multiculturalism, the word multiculturalism, it was like overnight, the schools, the government, the entertainment complex were all using the term in harmony at the same time, like overnight. It just happened. You never heard this word before in English. And as soon as you started hearing it, it was coming out of the government. It was coming out of the schools. It was coming out of the entertainment complex, like it was all orchestrated. I noticed that when I was a kid.
That reminds me, in the late 80s, early 90s, they started using the word prejudice often. They don't use that anymore. And they use it as a euphemism for racist, which came later. So if you were accused of being prejudiced against someone because of their race, or usually it was race or culture, and then, you know, 5 or 10 years later, it just was outright, you're a racist.
Well, it wasn't too long ago that words like discriminating and prejudicial were actually, unless they were used in a court of law, they were actually positive words. To be discriminating was seen as a positive attribute.
Yeah, because it meant you were using your brain. You were discriminating from one thing from another.
Yeah.
Like in a positive way, yeah.
Bill, when we were coming up, we used to, if someone was cheating you and all that, we used to say, you Jew bastard. And now that language is gone. We did that all the time, calling each other Jew bastards.
Right. Anybody that was trying to short you a penny, right?
Yeah, and that's gone.
Yeah.
We used to stop trying
to Jew me. We used that term a lot when we were kids.
In school, I used it too.
If I got my bike for sale and I want $20 for it, and you say, think I'll give you $5, I'd say, stop trying to Jew me.
Yeah, that's gone. That's disappeared.
I remember my brother saying that all the time, and now he's a communist. So,
too bad.
The barter of the store would be to try to Jew somebody down. We use that term all the time.
It was everyday language.
And somebody with $51 bills in their pocket had themselves a nigger roll.
Yep.
I never heard that one.
Yeah, nigger roll. You want to pretend like you got a lot of money and it's all $1 bills, right?
Jackson, if you work niggers, you paid them with $1 bills because there's a big stack of money. They think they made a bunch of money that
day. Yeah, that's smart.
Yeah, seriously, I seen that. That was done. They do it. The $1 bills, they get them pull weeds out of soybeans and all. And the guy come out with a box full of $1 bills and pay them all in $1 bills.
Yeah, or the term nigger rich. When I was like a teenager, if you had $400 or $500 in your pocket, you were nigger rich.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and see, all that language is gone now, David. It's gone.
Yeah.
somebody that was nigger rich is somebody that had a lot of money as a windfall or something and went and blew it all right away and cried when it was gone.
Yep.
That's how I always saw that word.
Yep. He partied it up till it was all gone and then he cried about it. Yep.
Okay, we moving on?
Let's do it.
Zechariah chapter 14. Behold, the day of Yahweh cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof towards the east and to the west. And there shall be a very great valley. And of the mountain shall remove towards the north, half of it towards the south. And he shall flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Azal. Yeah, ye shall flee like as ye fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And Yahweh my God shall come, and all the saints with thee. And it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day which shall be known to Yahweh, not day nor night, but it shall come evening time, it shall be light, and it shall be that living water shall go out of Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea, and half of them towards the hinder sea. And in the summer and in the winter shall it be. And Yahweh shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall there be one Yahweh. Shall there be one Lord, and his name one. All the land shall be turned as a plain from Geba to Ramon, south of Jerusalem, and it shall be lifted up and inhabited in her place, from Benjamin Gate unto the place of his first gate, and to the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananiel unto the king's winepress. And men shall dwell in it, and there shall no more utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. And I'll stop there.
Yeah, you know, that one Yahweh and his name one, that makes sense if you understand that most people today don't realize that Christ is God.
Yeah, it's sort of a prophecy of a heresy. It's the prophecy of the reproval of a heresy, actually.
If right. There's one name... Sorry, Bill.
When he returns, then everybody will know that he's God.
And if there's one name under heaven which saves, which name is it? Because Yahshua's name means Yahweh saves. Or is it Yahweh's name that saves? Like, which name is it? Because there's one name under heaven that saves, not two or three names. One.
Come on, Joe. Everybody knows it's Jesus.
He got me there. I just hope these women... Oh, Bill, are you talking?
No.
Oh, I just hope these women that are ravished, I hope they consented.
I see my light keeps going on. I got a lot of little feedback problem, but that's been happening with this desktop mic for a while now. I'll turn the speaker down a little. I'm sorry. This is why I titled this my commentary for this chapter, Prophet of the Holocaust, and all these nations that come against Jerusalem, which are the primary seats of administration and of his people, the capital city, so to speak, of his people, all these nations that are gathered against it are destroyed. And that's the real Holocaust that we're waiting for, that all Christians should be awaiting, is the destruction of all the heathens and all of the enemies of Christ.
Verse 4, and his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives. I hate the conjecture, but I do want to share my thoughts just with you all as brothers, because I've thought about it before, and it's an interesting thought. We can't know. It's too far in the future, but it's an interesting thought. Christ, he ascended on the Mount of Olives, and we all know that. And the angel, the messenger, said to the men, you know, don't you see he'll return in the same way he left? And that means from heaven. And I've wondered to myself if also that might perhaps mean, and we're not aware of it, that he'll also return to that literal Mount of Olives, and he will come back in the exact same place he left. And that would explain why he's covered in Jewish blood in Isaiah 63. And he says no one was there to fight with him, because now today the Mount of Olives is in a land filled with Jews. And it's just a thought I've bounced around in my head. I would never teach it as doctrine. Nobody should teach it as doctrine ever. But it's an interesting thought, because it does say that here, and it could be symbolic for something, but it's interesting.
I always question that too, Jeff.
Well, he's going to return in the same way, meaning a cloud.
Yeah, I know. That's what I said.
Yeah, I just mean it was angels, though. What was described as a cloud, or translated as a cloud, he was taken up with angels, and he's going to come back with a cloud of angels. They're going to look like a cloud because there's going to be
it's like a great there. Cloud of witnesses.
Yeah,
I didn't know it was used that way in Acts. I know Paul uses that way in his epistle to the Hebrews, and he uses it that way in 1 Thessalonians.
The location was always my question.
We can't know. Please don't take me wrong. I'm just sharing a thought. We don't know.
It is interesting. It's compelling.
It's a compelling thought. That's why I wanted to share it, because I've bounced it in my head a few times, but we don't know.
That analogy makes sense, but like I said, there's no proof.
Yeah.
I in my commentary, I understood it to be figurative. Representing his gospel because it was so prominent during his ministry. The Mount of Olives has a significant prophetic statement, I believe, because the Mount of Olives is actually... If these mounts are identified properly, it's actually higher than the Temple Mount, which to me indicates that there's something better than the temple, right? Than the earthly temple. The Mount of Olives actually figured prominently in his ministry. Christ wept on the Mount of Olives for the trials which he suffered.
And David wept
his own children, just like David went up to the Mount of Olives to weep after his son Absalom had conspired against him. And if you think about it, today in the world, Christ's own children conspire against him. All these false Judeotards that are preaching this alien gospel of we are the world are actually engaged in a conspiracy against Christ.
Yeah. The body of Christ is essentially mutilating itself.
And call him a Jewish Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, I forgot to mention in chapter 13, I was going to say at chapter 9, it says, I will bring the third part through the fire and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. I never heard any stories of there being little puddles of gold and silver in the ovens in Auschwitz. So I don't see how they could make that make any sense. Oh, yeah. So the ones that wheeled them in stole it all before the Germans can see it.
Well, I thought that was part of the decoration for when you use them as soap in your bathroom.
Yeah, it makes it sparkle.
the thought.
One of my favorite verses in scripture. I don't know if we went far enough to read it. It's where is it here? Yeah, verse 12. And this shall be the plague wherewith Yahweh will smite all the people that have fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall consume away while they stand upon their feet, and their eyes shall consume away in their holes, and their tongues shall consume away in their mouth. What a sight that would be. What a sight.
That is, that's funny. I'm reading a commentary as you're saying that, Noble, and it says, appalling, horrible picture, standing on their feet, yet their flesh moldering away as in a graveyard, their sightless balls decaying in their holes, the tongue putrefying in their mouth, a disgust to themselves and to others.
Not appalling to me. To me, I just want to skip like a lamb.
Yes. They're already zombies to me, brother. They're zombies. Yeah, they so.
Did Jackson read that far? Or are you ahead of him?
I don't know.
No, I stopped at 11.
Oh, okay.
Should I go ahead and finish the rest of it?
Yeah.
Verse 12. And this shall be a plague wherein Yahweh will smite all the people that have fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall consume away while they stand upon their feet, and their eyes shall consume away in their holes, and their tongues shall consume away in their mouth. And it shall come to pass in that day that a great tumult from Yahweh shall be among them. And they shall lay hold every one on the hand of his neighbor, and his hand shall rise up against the hand of his neighbor. And Judah also shall fight at Jerusalem. And the wealth of all the heathen round about shall be gathered together, gold and silver and apparel in great abundance. And so shall be the plague of the horse, of the mule, of the camel, and of the ass, and of all the beasts that shall be in these tents as this plague. And it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the king, Yahweh of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whoso will not commit, whoso will not come up of all the families of the earth unto Jerusalem to worship the King, Yahweh of hosts, even upon them shall be no rain. And if the family of Egypt go not up and come not up and have no rain, there shall be the plague wherein Yahweh will smite the heathen that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all nations that come up, that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. In that day shall there be upon the bells of the horses holiness unto the Lord, and the pots in the and the pots in Yahweh's house shall be like the bowels of an altar, the bowls of before the altar. Yeah, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto Yahweh of hosts. And all that they sacrifice shall come and take of them and see therein. And in that day there shall be no more Canaanite in the house of Yahweh of hosts.
Amen.
Prophet of the Holocaust.
Every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto Yahweh. Didn't Paul say something like that about there's different kinds of vessels? Some are holy and some are profane.
In his epistle to Timothy,
are meant for destruction to be done away with them ultimately. Yes,
and so there's no unclean pots here, there's no pots of Edom, there's no unclean vessels, there's only the sanctified vessels.
All you who bear the vessels of Yahweh come out of her and touch not the unclean.
There's another correlation,
and so there's no Canaanite anymore, there's none of those effing Jews around. There's only
vessels of mercy is another correlation, and Esau is vessels of destruction. So that's three correlations. There are probably others.
Now, where are they? They've just gone back to their own land, I guess, somewhere.
Yeah, Eli James. the family of Egypt, that word heathen should be nations. It means of nations of Israel. And the family of Egypt is Israel. That's the family of the Egypt captivity in Egypt. It's not Egyptians. It's Israel is the family of Egypt.
So do you think there's going to be Israelites who will not go up to worship Yahweh?
Well, if they do, they're cursed, right? Or they're going to, yeah, they're going to have problems.
I think it's sort of rhetorical. I think it's rhetorical.
Yeah, it is rhetorical. By this time, they should all be worshiping God. They should all be worshiping Yahweh by this time. If they seeing all these things, if they witness all this judgment, and they still don't worship Yahweh, that then
I'm just done. I'm just done. Really if we That's get there, people thinking. Aren't listening.
If you still want to go down, I'm done with you. Forget you. I'm just going up to worship Yahweh.
Now here, everyone shall lay hold on the hand of his neighbor, and his hand shall rise up against the hand of his neighbor. That's Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39, where the enemies that flood in, their swords turn against one another. It's a correlation with that.
Likely because they're competing over Nike sneakers or PlayStation. Yeah,
and big screen TVs. And the last watermelon.
Right.
I just want to posit something. Could it possibly be the other Adamic nations, Egypt, and the other?
No, families? Because they don't have to present themselves. They don't have to present themselves three times a year.
I know. I'm just positing it.
Okay.
The family of Egypt can only be a reference to the children of Israel. I'm not saying there won't be any other Adamic people.
Right, but in 16, all the nations which come up against Jerusalem.
Yeah, that seems to me to be whites divided against themselves, right? White nations have always fought with one another.
Yeah.
Sort of like the sword in David's house.
Everyone that is left.
Yep.
And that could also represent people who are sort of like in those nations when all this is happening. Sort of like white tourists in the Philippines sort of deal.
Many scoffers, even certain so-called identity Christian pastors, look at this verse and proclaim that Yahweh is a universalist after all. And that this verse somehow proves that so-called people from among the other races, even those who are not from Adam, are going to abide in the kingdom of heaven. But that is not the case. Firstly, white Christian nations have fought against one another throughout the Christian age. We can clearly perceive that in the struggles of these last days, there are white Christian nations on all sides of every conflict, whether the conflict be political, social, or philosophical, and even in the event of an actual armed conflict. The circumstance will remain until all the enemies of Christ and every plan which Yahweh did not plan are eliminated. Secondly, there are populations of whites descended from the ancient Israelites scattered throughout the entire world, so we must examine the other prophecies concerning the punishment of Israel in the day of the wrath of Yahweh and discover what they say about the nations of people who are not descended from the Israelites, because Zechariah cannot be purposely interpreted in a way which contradicts the other prophets. Doing so, we find in Jeremiah chapter 30 that the word of Yahweh says, and this is repeated in chapter 45, "For I am with thee, saith Yahweh, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee, yet I will not make a full end of thee, but will correct thee in measure." Okay, it's repeated in chapter 46. And the same message is a message of assurance to the children of Israel in the aftermath of the Babylonian captivity. And it basically says the same thing. And this accords with Obadiah verses 15 and 16, where it says, "For the day of Yahweh is near upon all the nations, for as thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee." So I basically try to rectify that with the understanding that there are children of Israel scattered all over the world, and they're going to be on every side of every political conflict for that reason.
The gathering of the wealth here, that must be the dedication of the first fruits. You see it in Micah 2. Micah chapter 4.
You know, if Jerusalem represents the government or the holy city of our people, well, then it stands to reason that there would be people of our race who aren't part of the government or the holy people who are profane, wouldn't it?
And when we're divided into many different nations, we've always been divided against one another.
I just noticed in 16, if you look at the Hebrew, okay, I'll read the King James part that I'm looking at. That everyone that is left of all the nations which come against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year. But there's no even. It looks like even is added. It almost like indicates like, it's almost like a universalist narrative there. Even they're going to go up, but really it just should be Jerusalem shall go up from year to year. There is no even. Like, it's almost like even they're going to go up. Maybe I'm looking too deep into that. It doesn't look like the word even should even be there.
And it shall come to be that all of who are left out of all nations. It looks like who were brought on Jerusalem. Out of all nations who were brought upon Jerusalem, or that could be against, of course, Jerusalem. Who are brought upon Jerusalem. There is an and there before the next word, which is a verse to go up. So that's probably the word translated as even, and that is fair. The New American Standard Bible did not translate that, but it is a conjunction. It means and right after Jerusalem in the Hebrew. If you look at the next word, it is a vav, which means and then there's a word which is like alu or alap with a la, or it's ayin lamed vav, which is kind of like alu or al, whatever vowel you want to stick there to make it make sense. Allow. Well, that means to be brought up or to go up, depending on whether it's passive or active. And that can only be determined from the context. So even shall go up, or and shall go up, is literal, right? So that's why they put even there. Because that vav, that leading vav is there, which is a prefix that means and. Or then. Or even, or now.
So it would be better translated as came against Jerusalem shall go up. No, shall go up and from year to year.
Well, the and should precede the going up. It doesn't necessarily have to be translated at all. It's a translator's prerogative if he thinks that the words are properly expressed without it. But it is translated as even in the King James Version, which is also appropriate. It's also translated as kahi or as and in the Septuagint Greek. all of those nations going up upon Jerusalem even shall go up, or coming upon Jerusalem even shall go up and abase on Tahi.
Okay. So it's actually accurate.
Yeah, they shall go up each year. I'm reading the Greek to worship.
It's the just Lord, not the way King. The way we structure our sentences now, but it is accurate.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's fine.
Well, when we were
but
doing,
only the children of Israel commanded to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, period. So this indicates to me that the children of Israel are going to be divided among themselves at this time. And I think that we could see that, but we can't see the future. Reading the prophecy, you can't see the future. But that is what this is indicating.
Well, we've blossomed and we've budded across the entire earth.
I mean, the children of Israel are divided among themselves right now, against themselves right now in a lot of ways. Not on perhaps a national scale, but on individual scales. I mean, most of the people in our own country are our enemies. Most of the white folks that are our own kin are our enemies because they don't believe what we believe. And they would defend the spicks and the niggers and the chinks in a minute if we attempted to lift a hand.
Yeah, that's true.
And that attitude is not going to change unless they suffer a lot of punishment.
Some of the governors of the earth right now are white people, and they're fighting for Satan. They're not going to repent straight away. They're going to keep fighting for Satan because as soon as God comes back, they've got all these wicked works that are going to be judged.
Absolutely. So our people are divided by them against themselves now. It's just not so clear in from a secular point of view. It's not so clear. I mean, the divisions from a secular point of view might be conservative and liberal and Democrat and Republican, but they're not really the divisions. Because from our viewpoint, most Republicans agree with most Democrats and most liberals agree with most conservatives.
Rather a Jew than Nazi.
They're all egalitarian. They all are tending towards communism in one way or another.
There's a racial awakening promised in the Bible, I think. I don't know how that's going to happen, but I believe that'll be the hand of God that does that.
Malachi 4.
Absolutely.
Malachi 4, and I also believe Isaiah 63 and Isaiah 64, because there's a long prayer that spans through those two chapters. We are yours. You never bear rule over them. We are your seed. It's basically a prayer of racial awakening, and it says in the prayer, oh, that the heavens would rend open. So it's a prayer for salvation in this time. That's how I would interpret it.
One of my favorite verses is in Isaiah 63. Vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed is come.
Well, I love the exchange there between Isaiah and Yahweh. Like, who is this that's coming out of Bozrah? And then Yahweh responds to Isaiah. He says, it is I, mighty to save. And then Isaiah says something else, and then Yahweh replies to Isaiah again. You see that dialogue, and it's really cool. I love that verse, like, it is I, mighty to save.
Yeah, that's poetic. That's real nice. Mighty to save.
Yeah.
Well, there's one more thing that I wanted to say about this chapter, because didn't have time before, but the living waters that are coming out of Jerusalem, that's another cross-reference to Revelation 22, because there's that water that's flowing, the living waters flowing out of the holy city in Revelation.
Yeah, we saw it in the first verse of chapter 13 here too.
Right. And I was just gonna bring it up, Noble. But the in that day there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. And they're all pointing at Christ, and he's the fountain of living water, John chapter 4, right?
We see this in a lot of the Old Testament prophecies. We see it in Joel. In Joel it says, and a fountain shall come down forth of the house of Yahweh. It's in quite a few.
It's like where the dry ground and then this water comes and springs to life.
Well, we're sort of still that dry tree.
Well, this all, yeah, you know, this is a great coherence in the words of all the prophets, New Testament and Old. I mean, Christ in a revelation, as well as the words of Paul, as well as all of these end time prophecies in Micah and Zechariah and Obadiah and Isaiah. That there's a great coherence, a great consistency in the message and the symbolism. You just can't use them to tell the immediate future. It's not possible, right? But when we look at the big picture, we know that God is true. And we see what's going on before our eyes. We see this transpiring before our eyes. And we just pray that it culminates. But of course it's going to culminate. Just not on our time that we would like.
Under his perfect timing. Which is more perfect than we can really comprehend. It's more perfect than perfect.
Yeah, but we don't know it's perfect until after it's over with. We don't recognize it.
But it's perfect, and we know that, and we should just have comfort in it.
It's so incredible that we have this book that's like thousands of years old, and it's telling the story of our race from thousands of years ago.
Right.
It is. And most people don't want to read it. They don't care.
Well, it's just that it was never important to them. They were never taught why it should be important. They were never taught what it even contains. It's really been marginalized, especially in the last 150 years. I mean, 200 years ago, most people that learned how to read English learned from the King James Bible.
They're really missing out. I can't believe just walking around and not knowing this. I praise Yahweh that he's given us this, because just what a waste.
Yeah,
like, what do you have to live for? What do you live for?
Well, 200 years ago, even if people didn't understand it, which they didn't really understand it very well, at least, even if they didn't understand it, its teachings, its morality, its language really became a part of the fabric of their person.
Yeah. And even if you don't understand the narrative very well, it's still beautiful and you can still see its beauty. They can't appreciate the beauty as deeply as we can, not knowing the fulfillment.
You can also judge what's good and what's evil from it.
Yeah, that too.
They don't understand why they need to know it. I had one lifetime Christian tell me, or ask me, he said, why do I need to know all that, you know?
Yeah, right. It's really not that much of a challenge once you open up your heart to know it. It's not that much of a challenge.
No, it's not.
Yahweh wants his scriptures to be accessible to all his people. It's not like a really complicated textbook by any means.
Yeah, even children can be taught stories from the Bible. Like, you can teach kids the story of Noah, right? And at that level, it still has meaning for their lives, because the story of Noah, oh, all the people are becoming corrupt. Oh, and then this flood of God comes. But God saves those who believes in it in an ark, and he takes all the animals that he creates. You know, like, there's even children's stories in this thing.
Yeah, there is. It's a perfect book, and that's a whole other dimension to it. Like Bill was just talking about how coherent it is, and the more you study it, the more you see these types, the more you see the rhyming, the more you see how deep that coherence goes, and it blows your mind, and it makes you love and appreciate God. But also beyond that coherence, it's it's simultaneously the most simple book ever written and the most deep book ever written at the same time. And only God could sort of think that up, you know, like design that. Because it's a very simple book, but at the same time, it's the most complicated book ever written because it has more allegories, more types, more rhyming, more harmony than any other book which has ever been written ever. But at the same time, it maintains its simplicity despite all that. That you can just pick it up and read it and understand what you need to know. And it's incredible. Yeah, it's... if you read the Bible, I don't understand how you just can't come out of that not loving God. Like, how can you not love God after reading the Bible?
And all those stories, like, they influence your own life. Like, you'll be like, I want to be a hero like Samson. I want to, you know, if I sin, that's like I've cut my hair off. You know, I don't want to be like that. You know, there's all these stories. Yes. That influence your daily life too, and the direction you want to go, and your the choices you make, the way you see the world, light, not dark. I don't want to go in the dark, and the darkness comprehendeth not, those stupid niggers. Like, everything in it.
It's mind-blowing.
If you read and understand it, you won't want to go to the football games and all. I mean, it's sick to sit and watch it.
Yeah, all these positive figures in the Bible, they're there for us to look up towards. Ultimately, we want to imitate Christ, but we want to follow in these footsteps of the men who were sojourners like us too. We want to have faith like Abraham. We want to have zeal like David.
If you didn't have this book, like, you'd feel like, oh, I'm the only one on, you know, you'd start becoming depressed like some of these kids. But if these kids read the Bible, they'd be like, oh, you know, I'm just like Abraham, and I want to be a hero like Samson. I want to... Yeah, David cried to God.
He did. You know, David, he was so humble too. He would say to Saul, you know, why are you chasing me? Why are you chasing me around? I'm just a flea. And even though at that point Samuel had already come to David, but I'm just a flea.
The parents nowadays, they do nighttime studies from Disney World for their kids instead of what you guys are talking about, taking parts of the Bible and teaching about the flood and all of that. It's really interesting, a lot more interesting and educational than Mickey Mouse, you know.
Right.
Well, Mickey Mouse is actually mentioned in Zechariah 13.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, and all the idols of the land, they shall no more be remembered.
Yeah.
Good shot. Yeah, good shot.
David, we can probably wrap this up.
Good.